And I think there's a very positive vibe about fermentation as a whole. It's associated with healthiness, it's associated with taste, with authenticity. So I think there's a lot going for fermentation. That is at the home level, but if you see at a research level, there's also a lot of funding being made available at the European level, for example, or in different countries to investigate fermentation.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Daniel Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest is Professor Christoph Courtin, who's at the Laboratory of Food Chemistry and Biochemistry at KU Leuven in Belgium. And Christoph, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Can you give us, I don't know, some kind of introduction as to your area of expertise? And of course, we know why we want to talk to you, but can you tell our listeners your area of expertise that you work in?
Of course. So I'm a professor of food biochemistry here at the University of Leuven, and the main focus on everything that has to do with cereal grains. So looking into wheat, oats, rye, barley, and going from kernel all the way down to the product that you can make out of it, but also looking into nutritional aspects. So all the way down to fermentations, prebiotic potential of fibers, and so on. We also have a strong focus on processing, and from the processing also into looking into fermentation more and more as one of the ways to improve products, to make products more tasty, more healthy. So that's in a short answer what we're doing. But it's quite broad. We have a rather large research group, so we tackle a lot of different topics.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen that you've published literally hundreds of papers in the field, and your areas touch very much on interests of ISAT members, I think, particularly fermented foods and the prebiotic area. So maybe we'll try and come back to those two. But it's primarily you're a cereal biochemist. And so cereals we think of largely in fermentations as being subject to yeast fermentations. Is that correct? Or are there also bacterial fermentations that go on with cereals?
Well, I think in first instance, yeast fermentation, yeah, because all bread is leavened through yeast, or most bread is leavened through yeast fermentations. And so that's also where we started some 15 years ago, is looking at the interaction between yeast and dough. How does yeast impact dough, but also how does dough impact yeast? And so the synergy of these two. And then five years ago, we evolved also into looking into sourdough processes. And there, of course, you have completely different ballgame, which is much more complex, lactic acid bacteria, wild yeasts, and so on. And so we wanted to understand not so much the microbiology of the sourdough, because we're not microbiologists, but look at what a sourdough can do to, for example, a bread-making process. So that's one thing. And then in another European project that we're having, we're also looking at fermentation to produce cereal-based drinks, cereal-based yogurts, but also more elaborate plant-based products. So fava bean-based and yellow pea-based products.
Can I just ask, the restaurants I go to at least now, or when I go out for breakfast to a cafe or anything, the menus just seem dominated now by sourdough breads. It's almost hard to get a non-sourdough bread. Why? Maybe this isn't the same in the US, Dan, you can tell us whether it is or not. But why in Europe have sourdoughs become so popular?
Well, I think there's two things. We did an exercise not so long ago looking at Google Trends. So you can ask Google to plot the trends with respect to a particular keyword. If you do that for sourdough, you will see a sharp peak during COVID, because people were at home, they needed to have something to do, and they all started massively baking sourdough bread. Yeah. Then interest declined, and now you see it coming up quite strongly.
I think there's a very positive vibe about fermentation as a whole. It's associated with healthiness, it's associated with taste, with authenticity. So I think there's a lot going for fermentation. That is at the home level, but if you see at a research level, there's also a lot of funding being made available at the European level, for example, or in different countries to investigate fermentation.
The way you're investigating sourdough includes a really interesting citizen science component through your health firm. Can you talk to us about health firm?
Yes, of course. So health firm is a European project, so a research and innovation action project. So it deals with trying to do good research and trying to come up with innovative ways to do new things. And in health firm, the main aim of the project is twofold. So we want to go from animal-based products and make or help make the transition to more plant-based products. And we think that fermentation technology can help us do that. So that using fermentation technology, we can get most out of our plant-based raw materials. And these raw materials are wheat, oat, sama bean, and yellow pea. And so there we constructed a whole project around this idea of fermentation for healthy plant-based materials.
What do you think is the, I guess, the health promoting aspects of fermentation over non-fermented foods? Do you think it's the metabolites produced during fermentation, the actual microbes themselves? Have you opinions on that?
It's a very good question, Colin, because that's exactly what we try to elucidate or help elucidate with the project. We can only do a very little addition to the science that we have today, but it's possibly metabolites. And then we think about short chain fatty acids for sure. It's also the possibility that we have a pre-digestion of micronutrients, like maybe starch, maybe proteins. It can be modifying the fiber fraction in those materials such that the fibers become more available for fermentation in the colon. It might be that we're adding live microorganisms, and not for sourdough bread that we were talking about because that's baked, but if you look at drinks or yogurts, you're adding a lot of live microorganisms, and these could also be beneficial. So there's more and more evidence appearing. There's some very nice papers from ICEP in this regard also that show that the consumption of live microorganisms is associated with potential markers for health. So I think there's a lot still to be learned. And I think we need a lot of good controlled intervention trials together with epidemiological data to get to the bottom of this. But there's still a lot of work to be done for sure.
I believe you're also involved. You and your colleagues are helping to develop more intervention studies so we can get stronger evidence. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that's one of the strong points in Health Firm. That is that we have, of course, a part on microbiology. We have the part on fermentation technology. But we have a large section or work package, as we call it, on health and microbiome. So in there, we're doing five intervention studies. And you have to imagine that each of them is approximately 100 people large to have sufficient power in the studies, looking at very mechanistic studies all the way down to a portfolio diet where people are put on a diet with a lot of fermented foods over a period of a couple of weeks. And then we studied a lot of different elements on those people. So we're looking at microbiota, we're looking at blood values, we're looking at a lot of different elements. And so we try to couple all of them together. And that is done by, a multi-partner team, of course. And there's, for every intervention trial, I think there's like six or seven partners involved at least.
And do you think, Christoph, that, you know, if you went to a nutritionist or a dietitian, I think kind of almost universal advice would be not to eat too much bread or carbohydrates because, you know, a lot of people want to lose weight or maintain a healthy weight. Do you think it's possible, and this might be an unfair question, to kind of add value to a food that is regarded maybe by nutritionists and dietitians as being inherently unhealthy, a kind of a food that we should be almost trying to avoid? Maybe, I don't know if that's a fair question to ask.
Well, it's a fair question to ask, and I'll give you an answer that, according to me, is as fair as possible. I think bread has for sure a part of a healthy diet. If you look at the Eat Lancet paper from 2019 by Willett and co-authors, what you see there is that I think up to 800 kilocalories should come from whole grain consumption. And so whole grain consumption, the best way to do that is by eating things like whole grain bread. And so what we should avoid for sure is to eat too much refined products, but go for whole grain products. So if we do that, what we're doing is getting our fibers in the amounts that we will need. We all eat too little fibers in our diets. So I think their bread consumption can help. The second part of the answer would be that today we generally eat too much. So our calorie intake is too high. And if you have to reduce that, then one of the ways to do that can be to cut out bread products, for example. But if you eat a whole meal breads, that would be a bad thing to do. I think we have to reduce our consumption as a whole of a lot of different elements and not look at to bread as a bad food product. On the contrary, I think it's quite healthy. It has a good nutritional profile, proteins, starch, fibers, vitamin, minerals, and so on. So I'm thoroughly convinced that bread is a part of a good diet.
Can you talk to us, because people think sometimes that processing itself is bad as opposed to ultra processing or refined. Can you talk to us about what you would tell a concerned citizen about the value that processing can add to the quality of our food and to the sustainability of our food ecosystem?
Yes, absolutely. So I really believe that processing can also do a lot of good things to our food products. If we look at ultra-processed foods, I think there's a misconception in the sense that if you look at what people are really trying to say with ultra-processed foods, most of the time it's that the composition of the food is not healthy because it's too refined, there's a lack of nutrients, and so on. So there's a misconception there. If we go to processing by itself, I think by using fermentation technology, by using enzymes, by using the power of microorganisms, then we can really introduce benefits into food products. Just before I was talking about bread, in one of the things that we have done in the lab is to, let's say, pre-hydrolyze fibers that when you normally have a bread, the fibers are there as very large insoluble networks, and they cannot be digested by our microbiota. Now, if you do during processing a pre-hydrolysis step and you shorten them, you make them somewhat smaller, they become available for those microorganisms in our gut that need some help, and they become substrates for those microorganisms. And if you then are able to stimulate the right microorganisms, what you're in essence doing is making a prebiotic bread, yeah? So that can stimulate the right microorganisms. So this is just one example, but you can have the same example for changing starch digestibility, for increasing mineral bioavailability through processing, increasing vitamin B12 levels, for example, in diets of vegan people. So there's a lot we can do with processing, for sure.
And one of the aims, I guess, of the Health Firm project is to kind of maybe offer alternatives or to try and promote a switch from animal to cereal-based foods. Is that, again, on a kind of health basis, or more sustainability and global agriculture and so on, or probably you're going to tell me a bit of both?
Yeah, it's indeed both. Huh? The primary idea is that we have to shift away from animal-based product to plant-based. We don't have to do a complete replacement. That's not necessary, I believe. So animal-based products will or could have a part of our normal diets, but we will have to make a shift. And so to do that shift, we also have to look in how we can ideally process plant-based products to make fibers more available, to make proteins more available. Because a plant is built up in a different way than meat, muscle is, for example, or milk is made up. So milk is made for a very good bioavailability, while if you look at plant components, they're made for recalcitrance mostly. And so we have to break that recalcitrance of plant-based materials, and we can do that through fermentation and enzyme technology. So that's a sustainability part of the thing. And then, of course, while we're at it, if we have more plant-based foods, we have the possibility to introduce, for example, fibers, to introduce more minerals and nutrients into the product, and to, through the process, make more healthy components in the foods. So it's indeed unsustainability from an agricultural point of view, but also from a health point of view.
Do you think the benefits of cereal consumption can be transmitted through animals, if you know what I'm asking, that sometimes you see, and again, in restaurants, you know, grain-fed beef or grass-fed beef or grain-fed one animal or another. Do you think there are benefits that can accrue from, I don't know, modifying the feed that animals get to improve the healthiness or sustainability of animal meat?
That's a very good question. I'm not entirely sure with cereals. I know that if you go for omega-3, for example, we all know that we need omega-3 fatty acids or lipids for as essential lipids. And I know there that if you would add these components to feed, then afterwards, if you eat the meat of chicken, for example, that you can have increased levels of omega-3.
And I want to come back, yourself, if I may, to the, you know, something you spoke about earlier. During COVID, people kind of started making sourdoughs at home and using, you know, exchanging starters with one another and even fermenting other types of foods as well. If there are health benefits, and this is a more sustainable way of processing, a kind of a minimal processing of cereals that can make them more palatable or give them health benefits, is it scalable? Or is it something that's kind of boutique and, you know, people in Western countries with high incomes can afford to be messing around with sourdough in their kitchen? But is it scalable to people who really need access to plentiful food and food of a high health value?
I certainly think it's scalable, and it's scalable in the industrialized countries, but I think it's also scalable in developing countries. So the sourdough making process that we have at home, you can scale it to industrial scale. I don't think that is that difficult. And so if you go for the right microorganisms, the right consortia that now very often we have through spontaneous fermentation, you can also do that by building consortia. So if you know the right microorganisms that can work for you, you can build consortia and really have the health benefits that you are looking for. So I think there is that aspect, and that might even be easier at an industrial level than at home scale level. On the other hand, also if you look at developing countries in Africa, for example, there's often fermentation already being used in their traditional dishes. And if there we can find also the right microorganisms for them to ferment their cereals and their foods with, so that you might have additionally a probiotic effect next to maybe prebiotic effects from the fibers and so on, then I think we're really making a difference. And I have seen at the start of Healthfirm, I was contacted by a person that is actually doing similar things. So they're making this type of sachets where they have starter cultures. And so people at home only need to take that sachet and then put it with their cereals they're going to ferment. And they have prebiotic strains in there. And so the production of those sachets is quite local. So it's not something that we would have to ship from very industrialized countries to developing countries. So I think there's really a lot to be gained from this type of technology, for sure. Yes.
And is there any risk, again, of kind of cultural appropriation here, that, you know, we're potentially going to export fermentation to Africa, but Africa ferments far more foods than we do in Europe? I mean, if you look up almost any textbook on where foods are fermented, then in Europe, you see yogurt and cheese and bread, maybe. In Africa, the list just goes on and on and on and on. What do you think about bringing some of those types of fermentations to Western cultures rather than us trying to export what we do to African countries? And I'm just using Africa as an example. Asia as well has a huge number of fermented cereals.
No, you're entirely right. So I think what they are doing there and have been doing there for centuries or millennia even is quite an example for what we can do here. And so there was a project that was finished, I think, 1 year or 1 year and a half ago, which was called InnoFood Africa. So where actually people went to the, it was also with African partners, and there was a strong focus on fermentation also in that project. So to understand the fermentation processes that were going on there and then see what we can learn from them and not only the other way around. So I think we can learn a lot from each other. Let's put it that way. I think we have more advanced technology to understand the consortia and to really look into which microorganisms are there. If we look at their products and we analyze them and bring that knowledge back, I think they can also try to advance their knowledge and maybe make some tweaks to their processes. So to even improve what they have been doing for the last centuries or millennia even more. So, and in all honesty, the more you do research, the more you realize that traditions have a lot of value. So people have been evolving things into what in essence will be best for them. And so I really believe that a lot of what they're doing is already very, very good for their health and automatically without the scientific knowledge behind it.
Not just their health, but often their economic sustainability. You know, people have figured out things that could work. And so we have to be careful if we disrupt that in a way that's not valuable.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And we're kind of touching on it already, but where do you think the field is going?
Well, if I go to the Health Firm project, what we're trying to do there is to, with the citizen science project that you were referring to before, what we're doing is we're gathering sourdoughs from all over Europe and also outside Europe to look at these sourdoughs, pick them apart and see which microorganisms are present and also which microorganisms we could identify that could bring health benefits. So if we know that, and then we can start designing consortia that can help us do fermentation to achieve good palatable products, but also products with a health benefit. And I think that will probably be part of the future. Companies are already doing that, so don't get me wrong, we're not inventing the wheel. But what we're trying to do is to do it in a systematic manner, as other European projects have also done in the past and have created very nice knowledge. We're also trying to do this and then couple that to the intervention trials. Because if you ask me where is the area going, I think there we need much more evidence of these health benefits that we're claiming for fermented foods. We all believe it's there, we all feel it's there, but yeah, science is about actually also proving it and showing the mechanisms. And if you look at plant-based fermented foods, that is something that is still lacking. You have proof for yogurts and then other fermented dairy products, but there's little evidence actually for things like kimchi or kombucha or sourdough. And I think for the area to go forward, we need that scientific evidence. And that is also why we are spending a lot of effort on those intervention trials in the Health Firm project. So we will need that knowledge to bring the area or to bring the domain forward.
And is there a confounding factor maybe for bread, which isn't bread's fault, but many people use bread as a base on which to put other things. So I'm sure Dan, as soon as this is over, is going to have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich because that's what all Americans eat all day long, as far as I can see. And you've got that complicating factor, if you like. The bread is seldom eaten just on its own. It has butter or it has some kind of peanut butter or something that could potentially negate the health benefits of the bread itself. Again, not bread's fault, but is there any way of factoring that in?
It's a difficult one. You're entirely right. We never eat a product standalone or almost never. We always eat it in a diet. And so what is the impact of the different food elements or the diet elements on each other? And so you're surely aware of the concept of glycemic index. And that is one, we had a discussion this morning here on glycemic index, talking to students. And of course, one of the downsides of the whole concept of glycemic index is that you look at an individual food product that you eat, and you don't look at the butter that you put on your bread or the peanut butter or whatever. And that is going to change how that food is digested and taken up in your body. So the conclusion for me is that food is an incredibly complex matrix to start with. And if you have to start doing intervention trials and human studies, it becomes even more complex because the human body is actually made to even out all the different spikes and all the different responses of your body to food and others. So it will do its utmost best to keep our blood glucose level in check and the same for other things. So yeah, it complicates things. So that means also that results that you have in the lab in vitro fermentations or in vitro digestion trials, if you then do them in vivo with humans, then very often the effect is much more limited because of the complexity of the human body and the way it tries to mitigate too much change in the body.
For the record, I am going to have a bowl of steel-cut oats and I won't put peanut butter on it this morning.
Okay, maybe that's a good note to end it on. We let Dan get to his steel cut oats. Christoph, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It was a pleasure from my side also, so thank you for this talk.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info at isapscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.